6 o'clock, you're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, the 6 o'clock news.
For my little flame.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, April 22nd. I'm your host, Christian Knutson.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. In tonight's news, a new statewide coalition is stimulating conversations about climate change.
A Wisconsin attorney weighs in on state and national labor issues.
And in the second half, the Milkweed discusses Madison's role as the epicenter of dairy industry communications. Stuff Your Face visits one of the city's oldest organic urban farms, and Wildlife Weekly prepares for an influx of springtime calls.
All these stories and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for reports from around the world.
Hello, this is the BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. US stocks have recovered some of their recent losses following White House assertions that it's making good progress on reaching a trade deal with China. All three main indices jumped more than 2%. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is reported to have predicted a de-escalation in the trade war, describing the current situation as unsustainable. Speaking after the markets closed, President Trump said he would be very nice in negotiations with Beijing.
I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to play hardball with China. I'm going to play hardball with you, President Xi. No. We're going to be very nice. They're going to be very nice. And we'll see what happens. But ultimately, they have to make a deal because otherwise they're not going to be able to deal in the United States. And we want them involved, but they have to, and other countries have to make a deal.
Mr. Trump added that tariffs would fall if there was a deal, but not to zero. The International Monetary Fund has cut its global economic growth projections, warning that US tariffs are causing market uncertainty and slowdown. The outlook for nearly all countries has been downgraded. Darshini David reports.
The sweeping tariff policy unveiled by President Trump at the start of the month prompted the IMF to declare that we are entering a new era in which the worldwide economy would be severely tested. It now predicts global growth of 2.8% this year, down from its previous forecast of 3.3%, with the US suffering the biggest downgrade to its outlook, with expected growth of 1.8%. The IMF does not expect a recession in either case.
The world's richest man, Elon Musk, says he's likely to scale back his work for the Trump administration next month to concentrate in his electric car company, Tesla. Analysts have warned of brand damage due to Mr. Musk's role at the Department of Government Efficiency, where the tech billionaire has overseen large, often controversial cuts to federal programs. Tesla has reported a 71% drop in quarterly profits. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has condemned the killing of domestic tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. Gunmen attacked tourists near the resort town of Pahalgam. Media reports suggest at least 27 people were killed. A little-known Islamist separatist group says it was responsible. Here's Yogita Lamaya.
Details are still emerging of what exactly happened, how many gunmen were there, how many people have been killed and injured. Locals say that there are many people who've been rushed to nearby hospitals with gunshot wounds. The area has been cordoned off and a search is currently being carried out for the perpetrators of the attack. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has responded, calling it a heinous attack and saying that those who've carried it out will be brought to justice.
BBC News. President Zelensky has said Ukraine will not formally recognise Russia's annexation of Crimea as part of any deal to end the war. He said ceding the peninsula seized by Russia in 2014 would violate Ukraine's constitution. Mr. Zelensky's comments follow reports Washington could recognise Crimea as Russian to secure a ceasefire. There's been a large explosion at a military base in the Vladimir region, northeast of Moscow. The Russian Defense Ministry said a fire had detonated ammunition at a warehouse. Danny Eberhard reports.
Video footage of the incident shows a vast fireball and billowing plumes of smoke.
Woo-hoo!
Its force clearly impressed one witness, despite being filmed from several kilometres away. Russia's Ministry of Defence put the blasts down to what it called a violation of safety requirements when working with explosive materials. Such incidents do happen in Russia, but Ukraine also attacks Russian arms depots. Ukrainian reports indicate the site houses an arsenal of the main missile directorate.
The US health authorities say the use of synthetic dyes in food products will be banned from the end of next year. The Food and Drug Administration said that for the last 50 years, American children have increasingly been living in a toxic soup of synthetic chemicals. It cited studies linking petroleum-based dyes to conditions including attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, though food companies dispute this. Official Israeli messages of condolence for the Pope were deleted shortly after being posted online. They featured a picture of Francis praying in Jerusalem with the caption, "May his memory be a blessing," but it was swiftly removed. A BBC correspondent says this appears to show the Israeli government's displeasure at the Pope's decision to speak about Gaza. BBC News.
This is Christian Knudsen and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Republican Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is calling for a renewed investigation into the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Johnson told a conservative podcaster on Monday that he believes there are unanswered questions about the attacks, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Johnson rehashed a long-debunked conspiracy theory that the United States government was involved in the attacks. He also criticized a report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology on the attack, calling its investigation, quote-unquote, corrupt. Johnson said yesterday that he's optimistic President Donald Trump, who is from New York, would support a new investigation.
The Wisconsin Legislature's Rules Committee heard testimony yesterday on a proposed set of rules for election observers. The Wisconsin Elections Commission drafted these new rules, which lay out what election observers are allowed to do, where they can position themselves in a polling place, and how unruly observers can be removed. Commission Chair Ann Jacobs, a Democratic appointee, and Commissioner Don Millis, a Republican appointee, testified that the proposal is the result of 2 years of consensus building, reports Wisconsin Examiner. They agreed that current regulations for election observers are too vague and need to be standardized statewide. But not all commissioners agreed. Commissioner Robert Spindell, a Republican appointee who participated in the fake electors scheme to overturn the results of the 2020 election in the state, voted against the proposal when the commission considered it. Spindell also testified against the new rules in yesterday's hearing, along with a handful of other high-profile election conspiracy theorists.
Wisconsin is one of 16 states that has refused to sign a certification requested by the U.S. Department of Education to drop diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. One of the risks of noncompliance is the loss of federal funding, a fear among parents and educators across the state. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction hosted a local outreach session in Wauwatosa yesterday, during which K-12 officials answered questions regarding the loss of federal funding. State Superintendent Jill Underly said yesterday that congressional action is the only way for the federal government to legally rescind allocated funds. But she also acknowledged that the Trump administration is acting unilaterally, causing more uncertainty. Underly went on to say school funding is a priority in the 2025-27 budget proposal from Democratic Governor Tony Evers, which she says would help support the state's educational priorities as it navigates federal funding cuts.
A proposed expansion of the Ridge Breeze Dairy Farm in Pierce County in western Wisconsin has stalled thanks to a petition challenging its state permit, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Grassroots organizing Western Wisconsin, called GROW, and five Pierce County residents teamed up to oppose its state concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, permits. They argue the expansion would negatively impact the local environment, estimating that the farm would generate more than 75 million gallons of manure and wastewater each year. Their petition cites a 2024 report that found 14% of tested wells in Pierce County already exceeded the federal drinking water standard for nitrates. Nitrate pollution has been linked to health conditions like Blue Baby Syndrome, thyroid disease, and colon cancer. Its presence in groundwater has been traced back to agriculture. The petition also asserts that the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources does not require groundwater monitoring of the farm or its fields, which then poses a risk to Pierce County residents. The DNR is reviewing this petition.
UW-Madison professor Susan Brantley has joined a team of experts working to authenticate a painting that is suspected to be a Van Gogh original. The painting was purchased at a Minnesota garage sale in 2016, and the buyer later noticed that the artist's style is reminiscent of the 19th century Dutch painter, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Brantley, a professor in the Department of German, Nordic, and Slavic Studies, was invited to join art research firm LMI Group in its investigation. She said she believes the painting is a Van Gogh original, though their investigation is ongoing, and the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam is not yet convinced.
The Capital Times reports that its former downtown Madison office on East Washington Avenue may soon be demolished to make room for more housing. The building was built in 1927 and is currently home to the Capital Fitness Gym. Nearly 30 years ago, a city task force determined it was unlikely to receive historic landmark protections. But this question of its historical significance is back on the table. The Madison Plan Commission is slated to review a demolition permit application. During that process, they'll decide whether the building should be torn down or preserved as a historical site.
Today is Earth Day. There are several Earth Day events happening in Madison, from electronics recycling drives to park cleanups and wilderness walks. The first Earth Day, which was founded 55 years ago, was the idea of Wisconsin U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. He wanted to draw the nation's attention to the environmental problems caused by industrial waste. At the time, the Environmental Protection Agency, Clean Water Act, and other landmark laws had not yet been put in place. Alongside California U.S. Representative Pete McCloskey and activist Dennis Hayes, Nelson rallied nearly 20 million people to demonstrate across the country and advocate for environmental protections. The events of the first Earth Day and the national attention it drew have been credited with initiating the creation of environmental industry rules that protect the land and water. Those were tonight's headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Today is indeed Earth Day. To celebrate, Wisconsin healthcare workers and tribal representatives announced the launch of CHAT, which stands for Climate and Health Action Together. At an online press conference this morning, members from CHAT discussed their mission to spread awareness on the adverse health effects of our changing climate. WORT reporter Sam Marisi Wheeler has a story.
Lung cancer, Lyme disease, crop loss, and heat stroke. These are just a few of the public health issues on the rise thanks to climate change. That's according to the members of Climate Health and Action Together, or CHAT, a new statewide coalition of health and climate professionals. Representatives of the coalition gathered this morning in an online call to share their personal stories treating patients affected by these diseases. They say their first goal is to get Wisconsinites talking about the problem.
You may be thinking, why are we starting with simply talking about these issues today and sharing stories? Well, because studies from Yale, other universities, and public polls all agree and continually show that the majority of Wisconsinites are worried about climate change, and even a higher majority agree that we should pursue practical solutions. But when asked about whether people in their town or community care about climate change, people heavily underestimate the support of their neighbors and friends. And we can't get anywhere if we think we are alone. Part of the challenge is that only 34% of Wisconsinites say they discuss climate change with others, and even fewer said they heard about it in the media at least once a week. So today we are taking a step to change that by sharing stories of how people from across Wisconsin have already been impacted.
That was Abby Novinska-Lois, Executive Director of Healthy Climate Wisconsin, a health and environmental justice advocacy group and one of the many organizations involved in CHAT. When it comes to public health and climate advocacy, Novinska-Lois tells WORT there's strength in diversity.
One of the major benefits of this coalition is that it's really cross sectors. Our organization is primarily clinicians and nurses and healthcare professionals. So it's really meant to be far beyond the healthcare sector to help people understand what the health concerns are and what they can do in their communities to protect their health.
Healthcare professional Dr. John Moyer also spoke at this morning's press conference. A professor of pediatrics and community health at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Dr. Moyer shared his experience treating a young patient with heat stroke.
Fortunately, she recovered, but her case was a stark reminder that extreme heat, now the leading cause of weather-related deaths, is no longer a distant danger. It's already affecting the most vulnerable members of our community. This isn't just an environmental issue. It's a public health emergency.
Given Wisconsin's reputation as a largely rural state, the average resident may not consider air pollution a threat. But winters are getting drier in our state thanks to climate change, and Wisconsin is increasingly vulnerable to wildfires. Dr. Joan Schiller, an oncologist, says it's time to have a conversation about lung cancer.
Even with the many newer, more effective treatments that have recently become available, the five-year survival rate of patients diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer is only 6%. Air pollution is a class 1 carcinogen, as rated by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's responsible for about 14% of all lung cancer deaths worldwide, including in people who've never smoked.
Disease isn't the only public health risk associated with climate change. Michelle Danforth Anderson, tourism director from the Oneida Nation, recounted the food challenges the Oneida Reservation has experienced.
And because in 2023, the winter was so warm, and so with the warm weather, the trees actually blossomed earlier, and then there was a hard freeze, and we ended up losing about 85% of our crop, which not only impacted our business of the orchard and selling pick-your-own or apples to the local grocery stores, it also impacted programs for our food distribution for community members. We do special pickings for elders and different things like that.
Jennifer Gauthier is the director of the Sustainable Development Institute at the College of the Menominee Nation. She added today that the changing climate is making it harder for indigenous communities to continue their cultural practices around food.
While we have always adapted to change, many recognize that there are cultural practices that we are engaged with that will either drastically change or disappear altogether. So if we're disconnected from our Menominee food systems and our cultural practices, how does this impact our health?
Novinska Lois of Healthy Climate Wisconsin says that today's press conference is just the beginning of CHAT's mission to foster conversation.
We will be leading a couple of storytelling workshops in the coming months, and then we will be posting stories from all over the state, shared from students and other groups.
And Novinska Lois shared a reminder today, when it comes to climate action, we're all in this together.
If you're concerned about climate change and how it's impacting all you care about in Wisconsin, whether it's the places you love or the people around you, one thing I would like you to know is that you're not alone. It's important that we talk about how it's affecting our little ones or our families or our communities, because if we're not talking about it, we can't make solutions that will benefit our well-being.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Sam Maurice Wheeler.
Wisconsin's economy relies on manufacturing and agricultural exports, but a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, one that examines these industries in the wake of what it calls the most expansive U.S. tariffs in generations, shows the value of goods sold overseas has fallen in the past decade. Their researchers say the uncertainty surrounding tariffs could worsen an already bumpy ride. Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Exports are important to Wisconsin's economy, but a new report says they're facing turbulence between a decade-long decline and the uncertainty of new tariffs. Businesses and farmers across the state rely on exports, and some of the biggest categories are industrial, electrical, and agriculture. But the value of those exports overseas has dropped in the last 10 years, according to the Wisconsin Policy Forum report. The state has gone from the 19th top exporting state to 21st. Tyler Burns with the forum says the cause is difficult to pinpoint, but factors like labor costs, consumer tastes, and workforce changes all play a role.
Wisconsin is one of the most dependent states on agriculture and manufacturing jobs. And so any disruption to our access to international markets puts a lot of people at risk.
Burns adds U.S. tariffs triggering retaliatory actions could make Wisconsin goods more expensive, potentially causing consumers to seek alternatives. The report looks at state-produced goods, where they're produced, and which countries buy them. Milwaukee exports the most goods, with total exports last year valued at $9.7 billion. That's down nearly 20% from a decade ago. But Burns says this mirrors drops seen in other industrial cities.
Exports is an important measure of the economic health of an area, of a state, of a city, but it's not the primary measure. It's one of many.
Last year, Canada, the European Union, Mexico, and China were the top buyers of Wisconsin-made products, accounting for about two-thirds of all the state's exports, according to the report. And the U.S. has imposed tariffs on all of them. Burns emphasizes the uncertainty creates challenges, both for businesses and consumers.
Over the long term, we don't really know what exactly it's going to look like. I'm hesitant to make a guesstimate, but I do think there are impacts related to this uncertainty around where we're going to source goods, where we're going to sell goods, and what trade is going to look like.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Wisconsin law has blocked people on disability from collecting unemployment insurance since 2013. That is, until a federal judge ruled this past summer that the state's law is discriminatory and violates federal law. But the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development is still rejecting claims from workers on disability. Victor Forberger, a Wisconsin-based labor and employment attorney, was part of the team that sued to challenge this law. He gave WORT news producer Faye Parks the rundown today, and take on President Donald Trump's attempts to reshape independent labor commissions at the national level.
Now, Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development continues to reject unemployment claims from laid-off workers who also collect disability benefits. That's despite a federal judge's ruling last year that a 2013 state law blocking disability recipients from also collecting unemployment insurance actually violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. Why hasn't the state's DWD updated their policies? Where are we at right now, legally speaking?
You'd have to ask DWD why they haven't. In July of last year, a district court at the federal level ruled that the SSDI eligibility ban illegally discriminates against disabled workers who get SSDI benefits. That was in a motion for summary judgment, so that has decided the issue. Secretary Pahacek, who was sued in her official capacity, then has responsibility to then notify her department staff about that decision so that they can properly implement that decision. For some reason, the department is now saying that this eligibility ban still applies. And the reason I know that is because both the named plaintiffs in that case, as well as people who have not been named yet, are being denied unemployment benefits because of that SSDI eligibility ban. Now, in that federal court case, the class nature of the action was taken out of order. So that is yet to be decided. Normally, in these cases, the class nature would be decided first, but the court decided to decide the merits first and then found that there was discrimination. So now we have to, there's briefing and we're waiting on decision to decide the classes. Those issues mostly entail how far back the decision will go, and whether the named plaintiffs represent the classes we're proposing, and whether those classes should have remedies. Like one of the issues in dispute is, should people who never applied for unemployment benefits, let's say back in 2018, now be allowed to apply? And the issue is, if 2018, or even today, if you call DWD and you get SSDI benefits, the staffers will tell you, oh, just drop your claim right now because you're going to be denied. And many people then would stop filing and not pursue and even file a claim for unemployment benefits because of what the staffers were telling them. We think the department should not benefit from that discrimination and allow people not to get unemployment benefits because of what they were doing and telling people not to even apply.
Now, do Wisconsinites on disability have any legal recourse or ways to obtain unemployment benefits?
Right now, the federal court has ruled that they are eligible for unemployment benefits. As of July of 2024, they're eligible. So they should be applying. And despite what the department is doing, they have a right to unemployment benefits. That's what the court held.
Meanwhile, workers' rights are increasingly uncertain nationally after President Trump's attempt to reshape a handful of independent labor commissions by way of firing several members earlier this winter. The National Labor Relations Board lacks quorum because of the firings, and most recently, the Supreme Court blocked the reinstatement of one of the members. With the board effectively neutered, what kind of consequences will there be for labor organizing across the country? Is there anything the board can do lacking quorum?
I'm not sure about that question. I've not been following that NLRB case law all that much. Generally, when the board lacks a quorum, it can't decide issues at all. And so it leads to a huge backlog of decisions. There are some with the NLRB, there are some representation election issues that can be decided. So petitions to organize an employer, I believe, can still be pursued, but an employer could then refuse to recognize that bargaining unit after an election, and then an unfair labor practice would be created. And then because there's no quorum at the National Labor Relations Board, that issue couldn't be decided.
Trump also fired two members of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Can you briefly walk us through what they do and whether they could have been similarly impacted by the firings?
The Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, like with the NLRB, is the current president is exercising this theory that he has unilateral authority to decide all kinds of things and that he can dismiss anyone for any reason. Basically, the entire federal government is an at-will employee that serves at his discretion. That's a newfangled theory, and we'll have to see what happens with the U.S. Supreme Court and what they determine. This has broad implications because it essentially undercuts the whole point of at the NLRB, at the EEOC, at the Social Security Administration, whether you have a right to review of your case before an independent administrative law judge or a tribunal in some way. If these judges and commissioners serve at the discretion of the current president, then that is explicitly indicating that politics plays a role in the decision making. And so it's no longer a neutral decision maker you have, but a political decision maker who's going to be weighing political factors and not the actual merits of the case, the law and the facts that are currently being presented, which would basically undercut the whole point of due process in the United States, especially given that the vast majority of cases, disputes that people have in their employment or in their Social Security or basically anything to do with the federal government are handled through these administrative procedures and not through any kind of independent court case.
Can you speak to, just generally, the tension between the executive branch and the judicial branch and the consequences for the average worker if it becomes politicized, as you've described, or continues to be so?
Well, right now, the judicial branch has been pushing back. This is more about agency discretion and administrative review and the politicization of that review. I mean, one of the sad parts that's happened of late is that the legislative branch has basically dropped the ball on defending itself in our system of checks and balances. The legislative branch is supposed to be maintaining that the executive branch is actually implementing the laws to the best of its ability and in good faith. And at present, it seems the legislative branch does not care all that much about what the executive branch is doing. And it's essentially ceded whatever authority the legislative branch has to the executive branch, which is not good for the long term, because you can imagine if we get a new president, that president may push issues in a totally opposite way from what the current president is doing. And if there is no legislative branch, this president stands about how the legislative branch is essentially ceded this control. That means then that, the elections for our senators and representatives don't really matter.
I've been speaking with Victor Forberger, a Wisconsin-based labor and employment attorney.
You're listening to Local News by local people here on WORT.
Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. The milkweed explains why Madison is so important in dairy marketing.
Stuff Your Face takes a field trip to a Troy farm.
And Wildlife Weekly gears up for a busy season of rescuing injured animals.
But now we'll take a quick break and check in on some world headlines back in a flash.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. Following White House comments that good progress has been made on reaching a trade deal with China, US stocks have recovered some of their recent losses. All 3 main indices jumped more than 2%. Speaking after the market's close, President Trump said tariffs would fall if there was a deal, but not to zero. The International Monetary Fund has downgraded the economic outlook for nearly all countries, warning that US tariffs and market uncertainty will lead to a significant global slowdown. The US is predicted to be the hardest hit. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, says he's likely to scale back his work for the Trump administration next month to concentrate more on his embattled electric car company, Tesla. The company has reported a 71% drop in quarterly profits. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has pledged that those responsible for an attack on domestic tourists in Kashmir will not be spared. Gunmen attacked visitors near the resort town of Pahalgam, with survivors saying non-Muslim men were singled out. President Zelensky has said Ukraine will not formally recognise Russia's annexation of Crimea as part of any deal to end the war. His comments follow reports that Washington could recognise Crimea as Russian to secure a ceasefire. The US health authorities say the use of synthetic dyes in food products will be banned from the end of next year. The Vatican has released more details of the Pope's final moments, saying he was grateful to have been able to greet worshippers on Easter Sunday. The Vatican said his death was quick and that he did not suffer. And astronomers say they've spotted a rare rocky exoplanet, which is disintegrating as it orbits its host star. Scientists say the planet sheds material equivalent to the mass of Mount Everest every 30 hours. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knudsen. Thanks for joining us. Madison's dairy marketing publications are like no others in the nation, with some publications dating back to the 1800s and with data from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Dairy farmers and cheese manufacturers can follow pricing and trends, technology, and legislation. Listen along as Bert Zipper and Pete Hardin go through some of these vital resources and get a brief overview and history of Madison's Dairyland publications in this week's edition of The Milkweed.
Welcome to The Milkweed on WORT. I'm Bert Zipper, and we're talking with Pete Hardin, who for 47 years has been publisher and editor of the monthly newspaper The Milkweed, dairy farming's best information and insights, with their motto, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee on the masthead. This is one of the great dairy newspapers, and today's subject is Madison area as the dairy marketing communications hub of the world. Hi, Pete. Let's talk about this.
I don't know about the world so much, Bert, but definitely the epicenter of dairy marketing communications in the United States.
There you go. Okay.
This area, the preponderance of dairy publications, dates back to Wisconsin's history for many decades as the nation's leading dairy state. We're blessed with a wide variety of weekly and monthly dairy marketing communications, private and public.
So talk about some of those. What are some of the great historic ones and the current ones?
Well, I'd like to start with Dairy Market News, which is produced by USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service. Every week, the staff at Dairy Market News, which is based here in Madison, they produce roughly a 16 to 20 page report full of not only current dairy data, but also analyses of trends in the industry. And it's, in my opinion, almost like the data Bible of the dairy industry. Comes out on Friday. It's now distributed only online at no charge. But this project or publication by USDA is the source of what I would argue is dairy having more near real-time data available to it than any other major industry in the United States. We know each day what the commodity prices were traded at Chicago. Each week we have analyses about cheese market trends, butter trends, fluid milk trends, milk production. Then there's every other week international dairy markets covering Europe, Oceania, and South America. And then monthly data such as milk production, which they pull from another USDA agency. But the total package of dairy information from Dairy Market News makes us mere journalists much more effective because we have so much near real-time data available.
That's amazing. So if it happened this week or recently, it's going to be right there at your fingertips.
Amen. Now, we also have privately owned firms. Let's start with the Cheese Reporter, which is a weekly paper. You admitted getting it in college.
My parents got that every week. And when I became a licensed cheesemaker, I got it too.
Okay. The Cheese Reporter owes its origins back to like the 1870s and has been owned by different entities. Weekly publication, Dick Groves, up until a year ago, was the editor-publisher. Dick sold the business to a Virginia-based firm a year ago in the spring. Dick remains as the editor. Dick's been at it 45 years. He's one of my best, absolute best friends. Dick is an encyclopedia of dairy knowledge.
Wow.
It's just like you can't replace that level of knowledge.
Wow.
Cheese Reporter is now available online 3 weeks out of four in the month, and then a hard copy once a month.
Wow.
Then we have Cheese Market News, which is published in Middleton. That started in 1980 by Jerry Dreyer and has gone through some subsequent ownership changes. But currently, Susan Quarney, the publisher, Susie Q, started out as the 18 or 19-year-old, I guess I can use this phrase, Gal Friday, at the Cheese Market News at its founding as National Dairy News. Susan has persisted over 40, 45 years. She's the publisher. It does a good job every week. Then we have University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Ag Econ Department, produces periodic reports and analyses about dairy events that, you know, obviously based here in Madison, and the dairy economists provide a valuable array of studies also.
I've called them, and they're good for history, understanding the history of where we come from as well as the current events.
Yes.
So what about the Hordes Dairymen? That seems to be...
Well, we'll expand beyond the immediate Madison area and go to Fort Atkinson down southeast of us. Hordes Dairymen has a history of, goodness gracious, 140, 150 years, published in Fort Atkinson. The original editor and publisher was... former Governor William Dempster Hord, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest figures in Wisconsin history. After the Civil War, Hord and many of his cohorts perceived that dairy would be the future economic activity for rural Wisconsin, and they created what I think is the greatest example of economic development in our nation's history, Wisconsin's dairy industry. Hord's has published once or twice a month. It's a national dairy magazine and is well-regarded by many readers. Okay, then...
I remember my grandparents getting that and seeing that in their living room every week.
And then we have, in terms of general ag, we have Pam Yonke, the so-called fabulous farm babe on radio and television. Pam is a tireless agricultural journalist. She's got to be tireless to get up at the hours to make those early morning broadcasts. But Pam is a real important part of the agricultural communications. And we have, for example, a Madison newspapers. They publish Ag Review, which is a weekly farm paper.
And then we should talk about the milkweed.
I am based in Oregon, Wisconsin. I've been at it We're just concluding 46 years of publication, and I can honestly say there's nothing else like the milkweed in U.S. farm publications. No advertising, no press releases, and no big corporate sponsor. It's strictly supported by subscribers for all these 46 years.
And in addition to the great journalism, I would suggest it's the prettiest newspaper I've ever seen with the great colors that you use.
Well, I'll give full credit to my design guy because okay. I flunked kindergarten art.
In our last 30 seconds, what haven't we covered here?
I think we've pretty well covered the span of Madison area as the epicenter of dairy communications. I would note that the data generated and reported is vital to the industry's understanding of trends up and down, and we would be lost without, starting with dairy market news, but then the private publications, analyses, and reporting that goes on.
Pete, thank you so much. We'll see you next week here on WORT. Thanks, Pete.
It's now 6:41 p.m. and you're bathing in the live local news on WORT. This week on Stuff Your Face, feature contributor Emily Tucker takes listeners to Troy Farm, where she sits down with its director, Paul Huber. Emily and Paul talk about how Troy Farm is emulating Rooted Wisconsin's mission to connect the community through food, land, and learning. And of course, Emily asks Paul about his favorite veggie to eat, which as it turns out might not be his favorite veggie to grow.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Stuff Your Face. With spring in full swing here in Madison and things popping up through the ground every day, what better time to talk with someone who grows food right here in Madison on the north side? Today, I'm sitting down with Paul Huber, the farm director at Troy Farm, which is a program of Rooted Wisconsin, and we are sitting in one of the greenhouses here at Troy Farm. Paul, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for coming. This is a real pleasure.
Can you tell us about all the things here at Troy Farm that you offer the community?
Like you said, Troy Farm's a program of Rooted. So as far as Rooted goes, we got a lot going on. Rooted's mission is collaborations rooted in food, land, and learning. We kind of embody that at Troy Farm, where we do produce food. We produce food for sale through our CSA into restaurants. We produce food for donation to local community centers on the north side. And then as far as the land part of the land access piece is the nature of running Troy Farm. We have a lot of volunteers. So it's a really great space for people to get involved, get their hands dirty on the land, help us grow that food, get involved in the community U-Pick garden that we have up front. We also have 6 other farms and organizations that operate on the same land here as Troy Farm. Some of them commercial businesses, some of them nonprofit organizations, some of them making compost, growing produce, flowers, all kinds of stuff. And then the education piece, we host several community events throughout the year where we have different workshops available there. We host also high school groups and youth on the land to get their hands in the dirt as well. Zooming out a little bit, Troy Farm operates at the Troy Farm and Garden space. That's a 26-acre site. We've got prairie spaces, walking trails, forested areas, a huge community garden, as well as a kids' garden with different planting beds, little kitchen space, chicken area. That's where we host school groups and a lot of grade school aged kids, some middle school kids too.
That is certainly a lot. I talk with food folks all over Madison and from a lot of different angles, and I always feel like the through line and really the beauty of food is that it connects all of us very simply, but also in a more complex way. It's really like the intersection of many things in life. Looking around here, Troy Farm epitomizes that right here in Madison. You mentioned that it takes a lot of volunteers to do what you're doing. How can people get involved with Troy Farm in different ways if they want to feel more connected to the local food system?
I think the kind of do-it-yourself version of that would be renting a community garden plot. And as far as, you know, volunteering, we have a lot of different opportunities, again, throughout Rooted, and that means throughout the city, because we're on the south side, north side, and the east side there. But Troy Farms specifically, we have a worker share program where people can basically volunteer on a regular basis throughout the growing season in exchange for produce. I'm very sad to say we are full up already this year.
That's good, though.
That's great for us. But yeah, please keep an eye on that for future seasons. We generally just have an open door policy for volunteers. If people can't make that kind of weekly and season-long commitment as a worker share, but really want to get involved, we always encourage people to get in touch and see what ways they can help us out or get involved. We are working now on hosting more like larger organizations and corporate groups that want to do like a volunteer day, and we're slowly starting to build out specialized groups. So right now there's actually a prairie group that really just focuses on meeting on a regular basis to control the invasive weeds and do seed collecting to help maintain the beautiful prairie space.
If there are chefs or restaurant owners who are looking to source more local ingredients for their menus, is that something they can get in touch with Troy Farm about?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest place to go is like our website. Also, just reaching out directly through email at troyfarm@rootedwi.org.
I live on the north side, not too far from here. I'm excited to come this summer for the community pizza nights that you all host. Can you tell us how those work?
Yeah. So the pizza nights are going to follow the fresh tomato season. So It's just going to be 8 weeks from end of July to mid-September, July 31st to September 18th. And it's going to be every Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. Farm fresh pizzas, farm fresh ingredients. We have a wood-fired oven where we make those. And we'll always have like some kind of music, whether it's just background music. We might have bands at times. Occasionally, we'll have some educational programming happening on those nights. And then that's where we have our CSA farm distribution. So CSA members can come to pick up their produce during that time.
Oh, nice. Delightful. So Paul, as a farmer, and it sounds like you've been farming for a long time, even before you were here at Troy Farm as the director, I'm curious if you can tell us what your favorite thing to grow and then stuff your face with is.
Those are two questions you're asking, and they're not necessarily the same vegetable.
I love it. Let's dive in.
I love growing garlic. It's hard to stuff your face with garlic because that kind of wrenches your gut. I have tried to stuff my face with garlic by eating it with cheese, and it kind of works. But when I roast it, I will stuff my face with roasted garlic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes I put so much garlic in a dish that my wife calls it inedible. So that might technically be stuffing your face if there's that much garlic in it.
I think it's garlic.
So I think I actually did answer two questions there.
I realize what you're saying, though, that you might have a favorite vegetable to grow, and then you might have other things that you don't love to grow, but you love to eat.
Yeah.
Is there something in particular that you don't love growing, but you really love to eat?
I don't love growing peas. I love hate growing peas. There's some element to every vegetable I love growing, but then there's like the particulars of like trellising the peas.
Oh, yes.
And I wish it'd just be a little easier to grow, but man, I can stuff my face with that so easy. If we could grow sweet corn out here, that's just irresistible to eat fresh out of the field. But, you know, we're in the city. We have a lot of raccoons. They usually get to it before we can.
Okay. That makes sense. Well, this has been a real delight to talk to you. I'm grateful for the opportunity to sit in this greenhouse, breathe in the fresh air of all the plants that are getting ready to be sold at your upcoming plant sale on Mother's Day.
And Mother's Day weekend.
Mother's Day weekend.
So Saturday, May 10th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Is there anything else you would like to share with listeners that we didn't cover today?
Another great event coming up is Farm to School Aid, Saturday, September 24th, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. As we all know, big funding cuts happening at the federal level. That's really impacted a lot of us, and it's certainly impacting our kids because that means almost no funding now to support local foods in schools. So we're going to put on a party to raise some money, raise some awareness. Hope y'all can come out and join us. Some great food and drinks and great music.
Love to hear it. Thanks for sharing, Paul. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Do you have a burning question about the local wildlife? You're not alone. The reception team at the Dane County Humane Society's Wildlife Rehabilitation Center fields up to 6,000 calls every year from members of the public. As they approach their busiest time of year, Jackie Sandberg shares some of their most common calls and some springtime advice in this edition of Wildlife Weekly. It's tickling, I fancy it. Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to talk about the inordinate number of calls that we get in our reception program. And when I say that, I don't mean it as a bad thing. I'm actually really happy and excited that so many people call our program to ask us questions about wildlife and what to do in so many different situations. Our wildlife reception team, we have 7 wonderful, dedicated volunteers. We can always use more, of course, because answering phone calls takes a lot of time, and getting all of the information and the right information from members of the public is crucial to giving really good care for our patients in rehabilitation. So we have these just wonderful folks helping us to answer phones and answering the door when our doorbell rings and talking with the public, asking them lots of questions. And then we also have our staff that are triaging calls all throughout the day. And if you didn't know, our wildlife program alone in Dane County gets up to 6,000 phone calls a year from the public. And last year we saw 5,804 phone calls that we logged on our call tracker forms, and that's people that we actually physically talked to. And it doesn't mean that we were able to answer all of those calls. When I was looking into our database to see how many phone calls actually came into our phone line, and that means maybe someone didn't leave us a message, or maybe they tried elsewhere, we actually received over 11,000 phone calls just to our wildlife extension. So we know there are so many more people out there that have questions about wildlife, and it's really hard when there's so many animals in our state and in our community that need help. So we definitely do the best we can to triage as many calls as possible. And by triaging, I mean trying to help those that need the help the most. You know, an animal is injured. It's a wild animal that we can help and admit and take care of. We are absolutely going to do our best. And the quicker that intervention happens, then the more successful we might be in their care. Now, not every call we get is an emergency, and we still appreciate those calls because it's one of those that you might have a question about, you know, foxes denning in your backyard, maybe baby bunnies that your dog dug up. We want to be able to answer those questions. It's just that it really depends on kind of the priority, where sometimes those emergency cases do have to come first so those animals don't end up dying in the care of members of the public who've helped rescue them. So it's a really challenging position to be in. And I'm sure the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources runs into this all the time. They do have a call center and a wildlife hotline, which you're always welcome to try calling as well. It's also called the Wildlife Switch Line. So that number is 608-267-0866, or you can email DNR Wildlife Switchboard at wisconsin.gov. So you can find those. They also have some wonderful staff who are helpful for resources about any wildlife questions. So if you can't get a hold of our program or another rehabilitator, always feel free to call that number so that hopefully they can direct you to the next person that has the answer or be able to find that answer for you as well. So I think folks probably know this, but our busiest time of year is going to be in the summer months when we have baby animals coming in. So last year, just to give you an idea, in 2024, our program only saw about 200 to 400 calls during the winter period. So from November to about March, we only saw about 400 calls at most a month. Although December, oddly, did have about 500 phone calls. But that being said, into the May, June, and July period, that's where we're seeing 1 to 2,000 phone calls a month. So it's so many, and we do spend a lot of time talking on the phone as well. We actually spent over 400 hours talking to members of the public just on our phone lines, which I thought was pretty cool. And I would say right now, the most common calls that we're triaging are going to be baby bunnies being found in the backyard. We know that baby bunnies are being born, moms are making their nests, so be cautious out there. If you have a fenced-in backyard and you have a dog, it does not mean that mom bunny doesn't think it's safe. For
some reason, they still think it's safe, even if it's not. So be aware of looking for shallow depressions in the ground that the bunnies have scratched out, maybe the fur lining that they have taken from their belly and underbelly to soften the nest and make it nice and cozy for the babies. You might see rabbit fur flying around. Otherwise, they tend to enjoy putting their baby bunnies underneath bushes, sometimes in mulch piles, sometimes in little like rock wall areas, and sometimes just right next to your house. And garden beds. I shouldn't forget garden beds. They do enjoy that as well. So be on the lookout. We've also had a few of our baby squirrels, the tree squirrels, falling from their nests. So sometimes they're high up in those paper drays or in nest boxes. And then we've also seen owls that have been coming down as well, hatchlings or fledglings. So those are the most common at the moment, but we've also heard about foxes denning and being in the neighborhood. Now we do have to be careful during the spring breeding season when our foxes are making dens. They may still have symptoms of sarcoptic mange, and if you've heard that on the radio before, it is a mite that it creates a lot of itchy skin for a fox, and eventually it can actually create bare spots and open sores that can become infected, and they don't do very well once they have gotten a really bad case of mange. And we see it in the environment and passed along when they're in those dens. They're just sitting there nice and warm and dry and cozy, and the mite is happy. It's burying under the skin of the fox, and it's not going to leave until there is a reason to. So when we have foxes right now that have mange, if it's an adult and they've already put babies in a den, if you were to try to live trap that adult and then take him in for rehabilitation, there's still a high risk you could be taking a parent away from their kits. So we don't really recommend it at this time of year, even though it might be something we can treat. Really, the best option is maybe to wait it out and hope that that animal does recover well enough, or there's been a few years, but a few years here and there where the entire family has been live trapped for treatment and then brought back. That's really, really resource intensive, and it's hard when we don't have a lot of fox cages for our, the number of individuals that might have mange. But otherwise, if an animal is very sick or injured and it has mange and a fox curls up in a little ball and is so debilitated it can't run away, that's going to be an individual. It's not helping its kits, even if it did have them. And we definitely think it warrants treatment for mange. So foxes and coyotes right now, both of those species, we're thinking of our canids, they are denning, they've got babies, or they're thinking about it. And so if you have an active den site, just be cautious, especially if you have dogs or cats, you know, on leash or outdoor, indoor. They can become more aggressive at this time of year because they're trying to protect their babies and their den site. So give them a safe distance. Try not to approach them. Don't encourage feeding them or getting, you know, baby kits used to you when they're new to the world. They don't know anything about fear of humans yet. And I think sometimes people are tempted to say, oh, I want to go give chicken to the foxes or some yummy cat food. The more you do that, then you're encouraging them to be habituated to our presence, even tame to people and even dependent on us for food. And that is really not good for those animals. They're the ones that might end up in situations where the public thinks they're a nuisance or a danger to other pets or kids or people in general, if they're approaching and too comfortable. So we recommend humane harassment, which you can look up on the HSUS, Humane Society of the United States website, or check out the UW Urban Canid Project about foxes and hazing techniques. Otherwise, give us a call at the Wildlife Center if you need any tips or tricks, or we can talk you through that discussion. 608-287-3235. Otherwise, that's what we've got here today, talking on WORT about our reception program and all the calls we get from members of the public, and what are the calls that we're getting right now, and what species. So thanks for listening here. We are so glad that you are a supporter of the program, and we appreciate all you do to help wildlife. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Aisha Malik.
Sam Marisi Wheeler and Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection were your reporters.
Special thanks to feature contributors Pete Harden, Bert Zipperer, Christine Vertigo, Emily Tucker, and Jackie Sandberg.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Bay Parks produced this newscast.
Charlie Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Up next is Spanish Language News with Nuestro Patio. Good night.
you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
And it's 7 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, your listener-sponsored community radio station. Stay tuned. Coming up next at Nuestro Patio.
Bienvenido a Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
Panamá,
presente.
Puerto Rico,
presente.
México,
presente.
Venezuela,
presente.
Perú,
presente.
República Dominicana,
presente.
Cuba,
presente.
Costa Rica,
presente.
Colombia,
presente.
Honduras,
presente.
Ecuador,
hola, hola, muy buenas tardes y bienvenidos a una edición más de Nuestro Patio, el programa en español de WORT 89.9 FM, la radio comunitaria, hoy martes 22 de abril del 2024, del 2025. Quería disculparme, la verdad es que estas últimas dos semanas no he estado tan presente en la estación. Ustedes lo habrán notado, no hemos tenido invitados, no hemos tenido más que titulares. Y nada, estamos poco a poco regresando a la programación normal del show. Quiero extenderles la invitación a si hay más personas interesadas en participar del programa, ya sea como host, como colaboradores, si tienen noticias específicas.